One moment, please.
The National Broadcasting Company presents Lies of Great Men, a new series on great leaders in human progress, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of The Philosophy of Art and many other books. In his talks, Dr. Griggs is building a story of civilization based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influences his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss Shakespeare, unifier of the English-speaking world. We now present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friends, Shakespeare is the possession in common of all who speak English as their native tongue. I question if he is not our greatest possession. Not only is he a chief source of that remarkable English patriotism which has enabled England always to muddle through, as they call it, but he is the strongest influence in unifying the English-speaking world. One of the four great masters who stand first in world literature, Shakespeare is distinguished in that high company by the wonderful reality in his portrayal of men and women. They are alive with our own red blood in their veins. We understand them in their vices and virtues. With this, Shakespeare is the supreme master of English expression, a diction pungent, varied, melodious, epigrammatic, imagery poured out as from nature's own source, metaphors tumbling over each other like the waves of a storm-tossed summer sea. It is these qualities that have made Shakespeare a sort of Bible, not only for scholar, teacher, and poet, but for the lawyer, preacher, physician, and businessman. Innumerable quotations from Shakespeare have become part of our common speech. When one is cited, we are often amused to have the speaker say, "Is that from the Bible or Shakespeare?" It is a pity that these greatest men get put apart on a pedestal of superiority, since men of genius are more and not less human than the rest of us. Talent may be an exaggerated faculty, but true genius is humanity multiplied. Men of genius have lived more, loved more, suffered more, sometimes even sinned more than other men. Great art never comes out of the study alone, but from the sweet and smart of human living. It is especially necessary to recognize this with Shakespeare, as the story of his life is so dim. There are even those who doubt that the man who was born at Stratford-on-Avon in 1564 and who died there in 1616 and bore the name of William Shakespeare really wrote the dramas that bear his name. Even if that skepticism be rejected, how little we know of his outer life. But we do know the mind that created the dramas in its unfolding development through the works themselves. The Elizabethan age was for England what the Renaissance had been for Italy. England in 1600 had reached much the same point of development that Italy had reached in 1500. In both was the same eager interest in the earth life, in adventure and scientific discovery. Because England awakened later, there were wide differences. England was deeply influenced by Italy, as evidenced by Shakespeare's borrowing so many of his plots directly from Italian literature. Then between the two epochs had come the Reformation and the religious struggles that followed. Thus, while Italy found her expression in painting, earnest, practical Anglo-Saxon England gave her highest expression in the drama, portraying men and women in action and relation on the stage that echoes the stage of time. If you chart a period of productive art, you find that it goes through some modification of a half circle. The forces of the epoch are born, they pass through youth to maturity, they grow old and die out, or go over into another epoch. The men on the uprising slope have a wealth of ideas, emotion, and imagination, but are experimenters in their art. The men on the declining slope have less and less to say, as the inspiration of the age has been largely worked out, but the vehicle of their art is perfected to their hand. The uprising slope is thus always romantic, the declining classical. The Elizabethan age passes through exactly such a half circle. It rises through the outpourings of Kidd, Lilly, Nash, and Green to Marlowe of the mighty line, then down through Beaumont and Fletcher, Ford, Massinger, and Webster to the singers of the court of Charles I, writing poems to their mistress's eyebrow or the mole on the back of her neck, past masters in saying nothing exquisitely. Just at the top comes Shakespeare, where the most perfect balance is possible of content and form, significance and beauty. Shakespeare attended the grammar school at Stratford until the age of 14, and during his boyhood evidently came to love devotedly that serene, picturesque nature world of Middle England. At 14, he disappeared from the stage of history for 5 years, but probably was employed in some gainful occupation to assist his father, then in reduced circumstances. At 19, he reappears, suddenly married to a woman a half dozen years older, the marriage evidently the result of a passionate, youthful love affair. Early in his 20s, he went up to London, soon finding a place in the theater and producing his first play at 26. Then, for the 2 decades of his working life, he produced an average of 2 plays a year. His earnings as actor and small fees as dramatist were much increased by his part ownership of a theater in which his plays were given. All through the years, he evidently cherished the hope of acquiring enough to retire as one of the country landed gentry. The year that Hamlet was entered on the stationer's register in London, he purchased a considerable estate at Stratford and became William Shakespeare Gentleman. At about 48, he carried out his dream of retiring, but the long, quiet period he anticipated was denied him, as he died at the comparatively early age of 52. Could this man have produced those dramas? My answer is yes, for 3 reasons. First, there was the early begun, intimate, and long-continued contact with the beautiful nature world. Second, while Shakespeare was not a trained university scholar, he had read widely in great literature and history, and he possessed that divining quality of mind that some persons seem to bring into the world with them, making us wonder if they have not lived 1,000 years before they were born. Shakespeare could take 20 pages of Plutarch and see ancient Rome alive as it was. Third, his profession of actor and dramatist brought him into contact with all phases of London life, high and low, with the opportunity for intense experience. Shakespeare's first play, Love's Labour's Lost, is a young man's work, full of eager love of life, satirizing follies of the time with much verbal fireworks, and with a wealth of lyric beauty poured over the whole. This is the spirit of his early comedies, reaching culminating expression in that play of exuberant fancy, A Midsummer Night's Dream. Parallel with these comedies, Shakespeare began his serious study of English history and produced some 10 plays interpreting his country's past. His interest was not in the progress of the people of England, but rather in the growth of the soul of England as shown in her kings and great nobles. He was a humanist, but no democrat. His English history plays are thus rightly described as a mirror for kings rather than of peoples. Suddenly among these early plays appears one called a comedy, but with a hero too big, too tragic for the limits of a beautiful poetic comedy. And in Shylock and The Merchant of Venice, we find Shakespeare's first deep awakening to the tragic conflicts of life and the ethical laws dominating human character and conduct. Having completed his history plays, Shakespeare dismissed that subject and never returned to it again, except to write the Queen Catherine scenes in Henry VIII, just at the end of his career. As if in disgust with the vices and perfidies of courts and kings, he turned to rest himself and us in that lovely poetic comedy that well deserves its title, because in it everything goes as you like it. Nevertheless, a dark thread runs through that charming play, a grave questioning of life. It is evident in the half-humorous, half-cynical sayings of Jaques, in the reflections of the chief characters on the evils of the world. Evidently, a shadow had fallen across Shakespeare's inner life, whether resulting from the ripening of his mind or from some tragic personal experience such as is shadowed forth in the sonnets, the bitter questioning is there. It was no permanent pessimism, however. The characters of the play are all involuntary exiles. They talk charmingly of the sweet uses of adversity, but like all the rest of us, they abandon those sweet uses at the earliest opportunity. As they make their return to the world of courts and kings at the close of that lovely play, so Shakespeare made his in that unrivaled series of great tragedies, beginning with Julius Caesar in 1601. In that play, Shakespeare studied the relation of the citizen to the state and showed how dictators arise out of the ruin of republics. He seems to have brought together all the types of men and conduct that threaten the safety and permanence of a republic. And all of them are alive today, only with a slightly different combination of elements. The next year, at 38, he produced Hamlet, the most profound of all searchings into the mystery of mind and personality. Then in quick succession came the great tragic trilogy, dramas portraying life swept by a tempest of passion. Of these, Othello is the purest tragedy of fate, that is, of the overwhelming of innocence, with no cooperation through guilt or weakness on the victim's part. Macbeth, in contrast, is the sheerest tragedy of guilt. The evil characters occupy the foreground of the stage. We watch the naturally great and even good man, Macbeth, his whole character perverted by the remorseless passion of ambition, spurred on by his more terrible and consistent partner in crime, his wife. We see these two heap crime on crime until an outraged world rises up and blots out the offender. King Lear combines the two motives of fate and guilt. All the good characters have some marring fault, making them cooperate with destiny. Even lovely Cordelia has more than a touch of her father's fatal obstinacy. The evil characters, on the other hand, are moved by passions we can understand. There is no causeless villain, as is Iago in Othello. Thus, King Lear gives most effectively the sweeping, dramatic spectacle of life. Concluding the group is Antony and Cleopatra, portraying the play of non-moral biological forces with the world at stake for which the passions contend. Is there any other group of works in all literature comparable to this series of tragedies? In them, Shakespeare has sounded every deep, pictured every tragic conflict of which man is capable. He did not stay on those bleak heights. His last plays, written about the time of his retirement to Stratford, Cymbeline, The Winter's Tale, and The Tempest, are not comedies, though they end happily. They are not tragedies, though containing dark, tragic elements, two of them being based on the same motive that brings the disaster in Othello. Rather, they unite in one the joy, sorrow, and humor of human life. In them is a new ethical attitude, no longer the remorseless return of the deed on the doer, but forgiveness of repentant enemies, magnanimity even toward those unrepentant, reconciliation of those once dear but long estranged. It is almost as if Shakespeare, before the close, had passed over into the sphere of Dante in the spiritual interpretation of life. When you read through such a fireside story of life as The Winter's Tale, and come in the end to the reunion of long-estranged husband and wife and the betrothal of the young lovers, you can almost see Shakespeare lay down his pen with that sad, grave smile mingling in one the laughter and tears that with divided sway rule over our common human heart. He kept his faith in human virtue. He kept his faith in human love. He kept his faith in the infinite meaning of human life, not as all sunshine, but because sunshine and shadow, joy and sorrow, it is infinitely worthwhile. He sounded all the chords of the heart, the gay, vivacious music of Rosalind, the sad strain of Desdemona, the weirdly tender chords of Ophelia, the somber overtone of Hamlet, the tempestuous chords of Macbeth and Lear, the avalanche reverberation of Antony and Cleopatra. These and how many others, all fused in one great myriad-tone symphony of humanity, worthy to make music in the ear of God. So he seems to us not only greatest of all who have held the mirror up to our common human life, but perhaps sanest of men. May I wish all of you, my friends, a happy Christmas of peace and goodwill.
Shakespeare, unifier of the English-speaking world, has been the subject of another program in the series titled Lives of Great Men, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author. Next week, Dr. Griggs will speak on Spinoza, philosopher of the eternal. Copies of tonight's discussion of Shakespeare may be obtained by addressing the National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York, or the station to which you are listening. Tonight's program originated in the studios of WTAM in Cleveland.